Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. This is our recap of all the LSAT Demon Daily episodes from the week. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT.
We have an email from Bilal.
Bilal. Hey Ben and Nathan. I'm a Demon student who's preparing for a mid-170s score on the August LSAT. This is not my first time studying for the LSAT, as I took a diagnostic test years ago and scored a 146. I was unhappy with that diagnosis. Oh, okay. So I busted my ass during studying with 7-stage and got to the 165 to 171 practice test range. But I wasn't able to break through that plateau, so I gave up. Cringe. That's what Bilal wrote. 2 years have passed and I'm ready to try again. I've been doing the Demon and my ratings are interesting. I have a 77 in LR. Okay, so for context here, the Demon rates you for all three sections. It gives you a score between 0 and 100, and it's just based on the questions you're doing. And as you do better on harder questions and do them more quickly, your scores go up. So out of 100, Bilal has a 77 in LR, a 22 in games, and a 36 in reading comp. I'm trying to get perfect games again, but damn, what happened? Okay, by the way, these scores all start at 0 for everybody, and they go up as you do more questions. So maybe you've just been practicing a lot of LR. Anyways, luckily I've plenty of time to prepare for the test. I work a lot, so my plan is to drill each section for 45 to 60 minutes daily. So that's 3 hours of studying. Once my ratings reflect the potential for a higher score, I'm going to transition into sections and time practice tests. I might also be interested in upgrading to premium for the classes. Any advice? Are the gains I hope to make realistic? Yes, the gains you hope to make are realistic. You're already scoring close to one. You're knocking on the door of 170, or you have actually entered that with your practice tests. So I'm not concerned about that. I am concerned about your study plan, though.
Yeah, Bilal, my best advice, and this is like a, you know, it's an advertisement for myself, but sign up for 1 month of our live program and start coming to our classes, because our teachers would never let you have, you've been wasting time on this study plan, and our teachers never would have let you get away with it. You need to be doing maybe not full-timed practice tests, but you need to be doing timed sections right now. I mean, you've scored 165 to 171 before. Why the hell aren't you doing timed sections?
Side note, and this is not necessarily intentional, but if you do a time section, your scores in games and reading comp will bump up a lot faster. Because if all you're doing is drilling, the drilling tool is taking you through easier questions. And as you prove yourself, it's going up. But when you do a time section, you can immediately prove yourself on harder questions, because the time section has level 5, level 4 questions in it. And if you're doing that well, it's going to recognize that and be like, okay, well, you just did really well on those harder questions. So boom, your scores are going to jump up. It honestly looks like you've just been drilling mostly logical reasoning. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Start doing timed sections. If you're studying for 3 hours a day, then you can certainly do one timed section as part of that 3 hours every day.
Absolutely.
Rotate through games, LR, RC, games, LR, RC. Yep. And thoroughly review all of the mistakes you're making. I think you'll see your ratings go up immediately. Not that ratings really ultimately are what we're going for. We're going for a higher LSAT score. You can also merge the section scores together to give yourself a full practice test score, so that you can watch your progress on the 120 to 180 LSAT scale. But the thing I really want you to do, Bilal, is come show up in class and talk to us, because if you're doing this wrong, then you're doing a million other things wrong. And your time is your most valuable resource, but right now you're wasting time. You're working real hard, but you're just not efficient enough in your study time. And I don't know what you're doing wrong until I talk to you. You're probably doing wrong things on questions. You're doing wrong things in your approach to games. You're doing who knows how many different tactical and strategic errors you're making. And so a lot of people do this. They like start with basic, and then they're like, well, I'll upgrade to live closer to the test.
Yeah.
But I would rather you do just 1 month of live. Come to as many classes as you can. say hi, you know, like if you can comment in the chat, turn on your camera, make a comment, like really like engage with all of our awesome teachers. Because if you come hang out with a bunch of badasses who all scored in the 170s, you're going to find those breakthroughs, I think, a hell of a lot faster. Then you could go back to studying on basic by yourself for as long as you need to.
Yeah.
But come say hi is my best advice. And by the way, I do have free classes every other Thursday. I do my study group. That's free on Zoom. All you need is a Demon free account. So everybody is invited to that class. 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And Bilal, you should be at that too. If you haven't already, you should come to that and engage. Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Sarah Kamuni. Sarah is an LSAT Demon teacher. She's a Harvard 1L. How you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing well, thanks. It's coming up to the end of our second semester of law school, and I'm still here, and that's all I can really ask for. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. We were catching up just a little bit before we started recording, and you said things like the 1L year. You said it felt like it was, or the first semester anyway, you said it felt like it was a hazing ritual. And you said you felt like you were inside a blender. Why don't you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think what I was trying to express is that it is a lot of work all the time. And it really, really feels like a test of how much you want to be there, to be honest. So definitely not a decision to be undertaken lightly. I can still say at this point that I'm enjoying myself and I'm really happy with my experience so far. And I don't have regrets, but I think my work-life balance has regrets on my behalf because I don't even know if I've ever worked this hard ever for any reason, like not in a full-time job, like not in any other context where you're just constantly having to operate at such a high level all the time. Can be very challenging. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you have to take it as you have to take the words as seriously as you take them on the LSAT, which is like almost the only lesson of the LSAT is read it carefully and understand what it says. You have to like really understand these words. You have to read them and figure out what they mean. Law school is like that. And you're learning all this weird arcane legal mumbo jumbo that has evolved over hundreds of years that may or may not make any sense in and of itself. And you are expected to understand it and memorize it.
Yes, I think between personal jurisdiction and the rule of perpetuities, those are two memorable low points for me. And on your point about the careful reading, there was one point last semester in our criminal law class, and to quote my professor directly, she said, "The best reader wins," right? I think we were talking about like statutory interpretation or something. And I was like, man, I wish Nathan was here to hear this. But yeah, it's, I will say that sufficient and necessary comes up quite a lot.
Oh, all the time. I like constantly you would see just court opinions where the judge, whoever was writing the opinion, is like confusing sufficient for necessary or calling someone else out for confusing sufficient for necessary. It's just like a super common.
Yeah, there was when we were, I think last semester in torts, talking about, I wish I could remember exactly, but talking specifically about causation, like multiple sufficient conditions was a theory that came up, and this professor had like a whole slide trying to really hammer this like necessary versus sufficient thing. And I was thinking, wow, the LSAT has actually saved me to some extent, because I think I know what's going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have a fetish. The LSAT has a fetish for sufficient and necessary conditions for a reason, which is you have to understand that shit. It's like you end up with really dumb decisions if you don't understand the difference between the two.
Praise a demon. Wow. Because I would have been lost otherwise.
So, okay, so you're a Harvard 1L. You are still a tutor for us. How's the tutoring gone?
It's been really, really good. I really love working with tutoring students and getting to kind of see their progress sometimes over, you know, the course of several months. It's definitely, I think, changed in terms of, I find myself using like very law school words all the time. Like today in a tutoring session, I'm pretty sure I said that something wasn't dispositive. And then as soon as I said it, I was like, oh, I hate myself. Like, why did I pick up this vocabulary? But no, it's been really fun. And it's also, this sounds really strange, but it's almost been, even though the LSAT is completely grounded in law school stuff, like getting to hang out with somebody who isn't going to want to talk about like civil procedure or whatever is going on in school that week has actually been really nice. And it kind of reminds me of like the exciting kind of build up to going to law school. And yeah, so it's been good. It's definitely been, I think it's a great gig to have on the side of law school because it's fun. Like I really enjoy doing it. And I get to meet really, really cool people, as in our students along the way. So as law school jobs go, I can't complain.
That's amazing. What are you doing this summer?
This summer, I'm working at an asylum seeker advocacy nonprofit that has like an alternative legal services model where it's fully remote and they have like a membership base of asylum seekers, like 250,000 asylum seekers are members of this organization. And by becoming members, they get to kind of direct as a community the impact litigation that the organization pursues and also get access to all types of pro se resources and like high quality information about the asylum process, which is often like really hard to come by. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, that seems great. Do you have an idea what you're going to do the summer after, or is it too soon to start talking about that?
Too soon to start talking about that. Like at the end of this summer, we have the opportunity to participate in like the early interview program for different firms, but haven't decided if I want to do that yet. I'm not really sure because I'm like very, I went into this kind of public interest oriented. So we'll see what happens. But
have you already been scared away from public interest? Are you already converted into the big law?
No, I think there's a community of us on campus who are like really, really trying to resist that. There's been some amazing organizing on campus recently to increase the summer funding for public interest students at HLS. So that's been really exciting and really encouraging. It is definitely the path of least resistance. And for some people, it's definitely it's 100% what they want to do. And it is a lot of money, but I don't know, 100 hours a week. I don't know if I can do that. So I wouldn't say, I think there was a moment last semester where that kind of seemed like it might be my path, but I have kind of like-minded public interest folks around me. And I think one of the great things about our school is that, you know, there's a decent amount of public interest support there. I think like opportunities to do the type of work that I went to law school to do is still going to be available to me. The financial part is kind of hard, but we'll watch this space. I'm if I can avoid going into big law, I will try and avoid that as much as I can.
You qualify, if you do end up working in public interest, you're going to qualify for
whatever Harvard's assistance programs are for that.
There's a loan repayment program that is actually, I think, one of the better among like peer schools. So that's something to think about as well. The reason I'm being all kind of like blah about it is because honestly, among all the law school stuff, not a lot of time to really think through the exact contours of what the next couple of years are going to look like and all of those types of things. But yeah.
Cool. Well, I was going to say you have a lot of time to figure it out, but you and I both know that that's not really that true because
everything sneaks up on you. I will say that time seems to go really like much faster in law school. I don't really know why, but yeah. I'm shocked that it's April.
Yeah. Part of that's just getting older too. I mean, I've noticed just the older I've gotten, the faster time seems to go, but law school certainly will do that to you when you're busy. Time is going to be flying. Wow. Okay. Well, big news last couple weeks has been U.S. News, oh my God, released their new rankings, and Harvard, for the first time, that I can remember is no longer ranked in the top three of U.S. News and World Report. Of course, it's now number four in the law school rankings, with Chicago jumping up and taking a spot inside the top three. What's the word on Harvard Law School campus about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that isn't really. I think the only reason I know about this is because I'm embedded in like the LSAT prep universe to some extent. I found out about it from Matt, basically. Like when he posted in our Demon Tutors Slack channel, I hadn't heard about it. And I haven't really heard anybody talking about it. So I'm guessing that there's probably more chit chats in the admissions side of things. But I mean, I can't speak for the entire student body, but I think my take on it is I'm still at school having the experience that I want to be having. I'm not particularly worried about it. If there are substantive, I'm using another law school word, but if there's like, you know, real concrete reasons why they slipped in the rankings, and there's, you know, things that the HLS administration can do to, you know, improve students' experience, then I hope they do those things. But overall, I don't think it's really had too much of an effect on anybody at school. Like, I don't think anybody's sitting thinking, oh God, I'm not going to get the job that I want anymore. Or, you know, my resume isn't going to have the same impact as I thought it was going to have, those types of things. I really don't think that's on anybody's mind, to be honest. And, you know, all the schools around it are incredible schools. I think everyone is always going to be, there's always going to be some, you know, maybe someone goes up one, maybe someone goes down one. I don't know that it really means too much, to be honest. Yeah.
You're still at Harvard actual law school. I mean, whatever U.S. News ranks you, you're still at Harvard Law School.
Yeah. And it's like, I think that, I mean, especially, you know, coming from the UK, like I think there's international recognition with our law school that isn't necessarily there with other law schools. So in terms of the international students that we have on campus, I don't think much changes in that respect. And I think like fundamentally, like I chose to go to Harvard firstly because, I mean, yes, it's Harvard Law School, but also because there were specific experiences that I wanted to have, specific professors that I wanted to work with, things like that. And I'm having those experiences. Like what I wanted has come to fruition. And yeah, I don't think I'm not personally losing sleep over swapping places in the rankings with Chicago, but, and yeah. I really don't think anyone else is.
You don't know anybody who like turned down Chicago to go to Harvard and now they're super pissed off about it?
No. I don't think I've heard anybody talking about it at all, at least in my section, right? Because we're broken up into sections, or maybe I'm just not getting the full picture here. But as far as I'm aware, like in our section, we all have a really good time. We all really like it, and we all have a great time learning with each other. And yeah, I know people who did interview at Chicago, but I don't think there's any like, oh God, I picked the wrong school type situation.
Yeah. Well, you guys are smart enough to know that the rankings do come out every single year and they always change every single year. It's like they have to make some changes in the rankings in order to get people to talk about the rankings almost. And so, you know, the fact that they switched this year, they could easily switch back next year anyway. So what does it all mean? Probably nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't totally know the exact, you know, criteria that they're using, but exactly as you say, like if the rankings just stuck the same all the time, maybe people would stop paying attention to them. I don't know if it's just, so they have to make themselves relevant. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I think fundamentally I would be encouraging people who are listening to this podcast not just to select their law school based on, you know, what they think the its prestige is or whatever. Like fit, I think, is really, really important with a law school. And I know that, for example, like if I hadn't had some of the experiential opportunities that I've had in my first year at HLS, like doing Harvard Defenders is like an on-campus student practice organization where we do like public defense work, as the name might suggest. And that's something that is pretty unique. And I've been able to work with really, really great, intelligent, like-minded students. And when I think about that type of experience, like, that's the type of thing that you should be thinking about when you pick a law school. Like, where am I going to be happy? Where am I going to do work that I want to do? Where am I going to learn things that I want to learn? As opposed to, man, I really like the look of this school, but like, this one is a few things higher up in the rankings, so I'm just going to go to that because I think it's what I should be doing. I mean, like, it's maybe giving blanket advice like that isn't a good idea, but I would stress that fit is, you know, definitely something that people should be thinking about, as well as just these, this like numbers game situation.
Yeah. Thanks. Really appreciate that. What's your, so let's see, it's Sunday approaching 6 o'clock in the evening. How many hours of studying do you have left ahead of you tonight?
Oh, well, you caught me on a fantastic day because I've actually been doing research assistance for a professor, and I'm going to be spending, after I finish my con law reading, constitutional law reading, which maybe like an hour or so, I'm going to be working on a bunch of blue book citations. So I'm really excited about that.
That's what you're doing tonight.
That's my evening plans. Yeah, like I was saying before, when we were catching up, law school not consistent with friendships, fun, all those things. I'm kind of joking, and I have been lucky to meet really, really cool people at law school, and we do have a lot of fun, but yeah, a lot of work. There's always something to be doing. It just never stops.
We have an email here from Zach. It
says, hey guys, thanks for building a great program. In the course of my studying, one of the issues I find myself having with the games is the initial setup. I mean, you and literally everyone else who starts with the games, right? It's just like, where do I get started? How do I peel this orange? I can't get any kind of purchase on it. What's going on? So yeah, the initial setup is everything in the games. More often than not, Zach says, if I find that I did awful on a game or ate too much time on only one game, it usually started with my initial setup. And yeah, I mean, that we're going to say...
Yep. You got to build a good foundation.
Yeah. I mean, it's great that you're recognizing that, Zach, because a lot of people don't, I think. They're just like, well, these questions were really hard. Like, yep, they sure were. If you didn't solve anything about the way the system works, like if you didn't put the pieces of the puzzle together, then, you know, before you tried to answer the questions, then, yeah, the questions are hard. But it's not because the questions are hard. It's because you didn't figure it out.
You know, I like what you said there. You got to solve the system. And then the questions are just the mere... Right. They're just the mere like check in to see if you solve the system. And they could ask you those five questions, or they could ask you another 20 questions. And if you solve the system, you don't really give a fuck what questions they ask you.
No, they can ask me anything. I could predict what kinds of questions they might ask. Like my experience on the games is, and this happens on logical reasoning as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, if they wanted to make this a harder question, they would have asked this. You ever see that, Ben, on questions where you're like, oh, they could have asked this other question, which would have been a lot harder.
Yeah.
But instead, they just asked this real easy question. But that's because we have synthesized, right? We have connected the pieces of the puzzle. And it's an extremely lawyerly thing, because in law school, that's exactly what you're going to be doing. You're going to be looking for the statutes and the case law and the facts of the case. And there's going to be all these different interlocking, you know, facts and legal, like straight up law in the law book, plus various interpretations and theories. And you're going to be looking to mesh those together in order to come up with an outcome.
Yeah.
In theory, that's what judges are doing, right? In theory, we're finding the correct answer to these questions. But we don't, it's... You do that from a system of laws, and that's what we're doing on the games. It's like it's a system of laws that control the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're trying to find like forced necessary outcomes. Like, what are the limitations of this system because of all these various laws and the ways they interact? So when we talk about the setup of a game, that's what we're really talking about, is just looking at the interactions between the rules that govern the game.
Yeah.
It's simpler than maybe that all sounded. I mean, it really is a piece of cake once you kind of get the hang of it. But Zach says, when I go back to review, I'll watch your initial explanations and stop once the setup is complete. and go on my own from there. Usually I'll ace it or come close to doing so, providing I'm careful. What do you think of that plan?
Okay, so the fact that Zach is doing this during review is good. I'm glad that Zach is trying to do the game again that he botched. I would hope that he can start to implement this on his own before he gets to review. But I would also say, Zach, you're kind of getting help with the very part of the game that you're struggling with, right? Like, you're struggling with the setup. So I would actually like you to start the video, get a sense of where we're going, and then stop.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
Don't watch the whole setup. Yeah. Okay.
I love that you're hitting the pause, Zach, but just hit the pause a little bit sooner.
Yeah. The more you can do on your own, the stronger you're going to get. Now, you need some help. You need some guidance. I don't want you to go off on your own and build bad habits, but hopefully what happens is you start hitting pause sooner and sooner and sooner to the point where you now can just come up with the setup on your own. And then when you're reviewing, you may watch and see, oh, wow, I could have done the setup differently and then try it again differently. But the sooner you can pause, the better.
Yeah, we want you to see the system. Like, as you watch our videos, predict what we're going to do next. See if you like stop it and say, oh, I wonder where he's going to go from here.
Yeah. Yeah. And then try and then play a little bit more. And
yeah. Like, so get play that immediate those videos feedback in like 1 minute bursts or even 30 second bursts. Like,
yeah. Anytime you ask a question, right?
When we make one inference, you know, like we write one thing on the board. Okay. Hit pause. And now work on it on your own. Last question from Zach. Would you recommend just drilling logic games more frequently to build my foundation a little better?
I mean, I don't know how much you're drilling right now, but
yeah,
I would drill like I hope you're studying, doing actual LSAT questions for at least an hour a day. And so right now, if you're only doing that for 30 minutes every 3 days, then yeah, you need to drill more or do time sections. I actually don't really care, but most people would benefit from going back and forth.
The logic games, I mean, I don't know if he really means drilling like the drilling tool in the demon. He might just mean doing logic games. To the extent that you're asking,
yes.
Would you recommend just doing logic games more frequently? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. The logic games are it's a test of how hard you can work. There are 100 practice tests with four games per test, which means we have 400 games right now to work on. And with 400 games to work on, Zach, that means you can master one per day for the next year until you run out of material to master.
Yep.
You could do four per day for 3 months. You know, there's a lot of work to be done. Even my students who have been, you know, you see faces in class where they're, you know, the people are working real hard on the games and they've been around for a while and they're still not there yet. But I'll hear from those people like, well, I've done now half the games and they've made a lot of progress. And it's like, great. That's awesome. You're killing it to have done half the games. That's amazing. 200 logic games. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 200 more for you to do.
Yep.
And so you like it's not just brute force, but brute force is one of the elements to it, right?
Yeah. A little word of warning here, too, is we're talking so much about games and people are so concerned about games when they get started that, Zach, I don't want you to do just games, right? Unless you're acing logical reasoning and reading comp already, you should still be doing sometime there. But sometimes people hyper focus on the games.
Yeah, I mean, it might be if games is your glaring weakness, it might be as much as 80% of your time spent on games. And then 10% on LR, 10% on RC, just to kind of stay sharp.
But don't let go of that too, right? Because like you can, it's just like you want to be in, and there's going to come a point, right? As you keep studying, your games are going to get better. And sometimes I think people are not aware of that. It's like their games pass their reading comp or their logical reasoning ability, and they just keep going with it. They're like getting the dopamine from that progress. And it's like, okay, cool. Well, Let's not get out of the habit of doing these other sections.
Yeah, stay balanced.
Yep.
I have an email here This is going to be a little bit of a different show, just me. And I'm going to read a couple of lengthy emails. I'm going to start with a shorter email from one of our listeners, Alondra, who says, "Hi, I've been binge watching your podcasts and they have helped me a lot. By listening to your podcast, I could already see what I was doing wrong and why my previous studies have failed. For example, tutors I have had in the past told me to read the question first and then read the passage, or to quickly skim passages to get a general idea and move to the questions quickly. And with this advice, I would score around the high 140s. However, I recently found out that I'm dyslexic, and I have been my whole life. I always thought everyone had trouble reading the same way I did. Unfortunately, I found out I was dyslexic when I was at the end of my undergraduate journey at UCI. I'm guessing that's UC Irvine. And I ended up with a GPA of 3.7 and not around 3.9, as I had hoped. My question is, should I retake a practice LSAT with the extended time accommodation I have received to know my real starting point and from there start studying? Or do I automatically start reviewing lessons and take a practice test later on? Also, do you have any extra helpful tips for people who are dyslexic? Thank you so much." Again, that's from listener Alondra. Alondra, thank you for writing in. First thing is, yeah, if you're accommodated for dyslexia or anything else, if you've gotten your official accommodations approved by LSAC, then you should start practicing. All your practice sections should definitely be with those accommodations. It's critical that you practice the way you're going to play on game day. So 53 minutes is a game changer, or 70 minutes if you've got double time. It makes a world of difference, and you should definitely start practicing with that extra time if you are granted it. I don't know anything, Alondra. Well, I didn't know anything about dyslexia, but I want to learn. And so I talked to Demon staff, and I ended up getting two emails, one from the family member of a Demon staffer, one from a Demon student who will be applying in the upcoming cycle. And they both had some helpful advice about dyslexia. So this is advice for dyslexic LSAT students from a student with dyslexia and from she's actually a teacher with dyslexia. I'll start with the teacher. This is not an LSAT teacher, but it says, "I was diagnosed with dyslexia when I was in about third grade. So I have my lived experiences with it. I'm also an elementary school teacher who on a daily basis helps students with a variety of learning disabilities. The first thing I would say is don't be shy about requesting the help you need. I know people who have dyslexia and have gotten approved for extra time on the LSAT. I'm not sure about the actual bar exam though." So there's Alondra, you've already gotten your accommodations for the LSAT. That's great. You might want to call your state bar and talk about what the accommodations look like at that point, just for your own knowledge. "I see it a lot," says this elementary school teacher with dyslexia. "I see it a lot that people either don't have experience trying to get their needs met, or they think the chance is so small that they don't try. I also know people who feel badly about having extra time on the test. The reality is, dyslexia is a learning disability that essentially slows down the processing time of your brain, and receiving accommodations you deserve just puts you on an equal playing field as with everyone else. When it comes to studying and preparing for tests, I personally always had a much harder time getting ready for tests and presentations, etc. Anything that involves memorizing facts and data are hard because my brain mixes up numbers and letters on paper and in my head. What I've learned is that I can't get by with memorizing the information. I truly need to learn it." Good news for you, Alondra. The LSAT is not even a test of memorization anyway. So it's a test of like skill, practicing a skill. So get really good at the skill of essentially playing the LSAT. It's like it's a game. But it is not a test of memory at all, which apparently is good for people with, or at least one person who is writing in with dyslexia. "I'm sure as a future lawyer, it would only benefit those studying for their test to actually learn. Yeah, that's what we're all about, is really learning the LSAT. So that's good news, I think, for you, Alondra. I always found ways to connect things to my own life so it would stay meaningful and make sense to me. My goal of studying for a standardized test was always to get to the point where I could answer questions logically and the correct answer would make sense. And that's, I mean, we teach that to all of our students, Alondra, that the LSAT just makes sense. That's what we're all about. So it's not a test of memorization at all. It's just read it carefully and make it make sense. So this correspondent with dyslexia says, if I was able to build a deep enough understanding of the content area, I could figure out the questions I didn't have memorized yet. And again, there is nothing you can memorize on the LSAT. It really is only just practice and get so good at the LSAT that you can figure them out. Something I often work on with students is mindfulness around standardized tests. And I think that goes a long way for those with dyslexia. Due to the nature of dyslexia and having numbers and letters jumble in your head, taking short mindfulness breaks can be extra helpful. Even just a short pause to close your eyes and take 3 deep breaths in and out can help relieve some of the frustration that builds up from not being able to memorize all the information you need to know. Well, again, it is not a test of memorization, but students certainly do get frustrated. So this also is a tip that would apply to anybody. I mean, taking a break, taking some deep breaths, that sounds like excellent advice for everyone. But this is specific advice for test takers with dyslexia from a teacher with dyslexia. So try the mindfulness thing, Alondra. We have some brief meditations that are now built into the drilling function on the Demon. I would encourage you to take advantage of those when they pop up instead of just skipping them. Okay, this email is almost done. I am not sure if this will help anyone, but I do want to say to anyone out there with dyslexia or another learning disability, I know how much harder you have to work to get to the places you want to go, but don't give up. It will all be worth it. I know you can do it. Smiley face. And that's from an elementary school teacher who is a family member of a Demon freelancer. Thank you so much for submitting that very helpful email. I hope it was helpful to Alondra. It was helpful to me. All right, we got one more email here. This is from a Demon student who's applying this cycle, who provided some helpful points. Okay, 1, know your diagnosis. The DSM-4 was used to diagnose mental conditions until it was replaced by the DSM-5 in 2013. If your diagnosis was pre-2013, it may be worth being evaluated again. Treatments vary. And then we have a link that we'll post on the show notes. So this Demon student says, I was evaluated at age 10 and then again at age 29. Over those 2 decades, my diagnosis changed, and I had developed several habits that newer treatments have helped replace. Good sleep is critical, he says. I run my own business, I have academic responsibilities, and I have a kid. If I can prioritize my rest, anyone can. Get your rest. Okay, so 2 tips in one there. Know your diagnosis and get your rest. Second tip, if you're concerned or unsure whether you have dyslexia, talk to your doctor about seeing a qualified professional ASAP. He says, but before you do that, talk to your insurer. The evaluations are expensive and they aren't always covered, especially if you're on Medicaid in your state. Next, he says, call your doctor for a referral, then get an appointment scheduled somewhere, preferably somewhere that they take your insurance. He says, I emphasize somewhere because the waiting lists at neuropsych facilities can get long. My neuropsych facility forced me to schedule 3 months out. If you're in a rush to make a deadline and you can afford it, you might also consider paying out of pocket to get evaluated somewhere more convenient. But for reference, my evaluation, he says, was $980. Jeez. So, okay, there could be, yeah, if you're not yet diagnosed, properly, it could be a bit of a long haul there, and you want to start making phone calls and appointments sooner rather than later. Our healthcare system, of course, is such a mess. It might be real hard to get this covered. Once you do have the diagnosis, he says, get your paperwork submitted to LSAC right away. He says, LSAC firmly rejected my appeal to have accommodations considered for the March 2022 test. I was less than 48 hours past the deadline. Don't make my mistake. So they're serious about you have to send in your accommodations before the registration deadline for the test. And the registration deadline for the test is like 6 weeks before the test. So if you have not submitted your documentation before the deadline, you're screwed. He says it was 48 hours, fewer than 48 hours before the deadline or past the deadline. And it's just hard rule. If you're over the deadline, sorry, you have to wait for the next test in order to get your accommodations. Understand how the diagnosis affects your capacity and plan your studies accordingly. This LSAT student with dyslexia says, one person's dyslexia is not another's. Treatments that work for some may not work for you. I love to read, he says, but I'm slow as shit at it. It takes me significant time to get through dense material, but when I do, I understand it. This helped me tailor my study schedule toward prioritizing reading comprehension. Logical reasoning and games came much more easily to me, but for example, if you have dysgraphia, which is sometimes diagnosed as dyslexia, you might struggle to make predictions or diagram a rule or world in logic games. Know how your condition affects you and tailor your study plan accordingly. Wow, I never knew that there were like different types of dyslexia. Okay, yeah, so learn as much as you possibly can about your diagnosis, no matter what it is. He says, your condition, dyslexia, will almost certainly require additional time for review after drilling, timed sections, or practice tests. He says, Nathan's one-hour LSAT from the Demon Lessons, it's a blog post that I wrote a while back about how to structure your time if you were going to give it one high-quality hour every day. He says that that turned into two-hour LSAT for me, and it paid dividends. Dyslexia is not an excuse to suck at using your calendar. Manage your time wisely. All right, this is coming from a dyslexic LSAT student telling you it will take longer and you shouldn't make an excuse of your dyslexia. You're going to have to manage your time better than most. All right. He says extra time is helpful, but it won't fix a poor understanding. He says, you've presumably got the extra time you need now, whether that's 53 or 70 minutes, great. But if you're still struggling to understand the test, the extra time will only help so much. Don't let your condition become a crutch for understanding the material. You still have to develop the skills to master the test. Set your demon time settings to match your accommodations, start practicing, focus on the question in front of you, and get it right. I endorse that idea for all LSAT students. I'm just not about giving you tips and tricks and trying to help you game the test without understanding it. You have to understand the LSAT. Really no excuses or shortcuts for that. Last tip, he says, get real with yourself. There are tons of career paths outside of law where neuroatypical processors like dyslexics can contribute in massive, meaningful ways. If you can't clearly articulate why you want to be a lawyer, it might be time to find a different pursuit. That doesn't have to be a bad thing. Lawyers and law students read a shit ton. I'm no law student, he says. He's just an LSAT student with dyslexia. But I can't imagine it's easier to be a law student with dyslexia. If you have any doubts at all, I think it would be well worth your time to talk to attorneys, other law students, or law professors in your area to find out whether you're prepared for the workload. Talking to law professors in my area helped me a lot. Again, that's from a demon student with dyslexia who will be applying in the upcoming cycle. Alondra, I hope that was useful advice. Thank you very much to both of our correspondents with dyslexia. I personally learned some things that I did not know. And I hope everybody found that helpful.
This email is from Mark.
Says, hello, Ben and Nathan. I am currently a sophomore studying applied mathematics and economics at the University of Rhode Island. After finishing LSAT Demon Daily episode 200, I felt inspired to reach out with a similar situation/question. As of now, I am consistently scoring in the mid-170s range on my practice tests, with the goal of achieving an ultimate score around 177 or 178. I have two tests scheduled for August and September of this year, providing me plenty of time for improvement. However, I'm primarily concerned that my GPA, which is a 3.0 to a 3.3 ballpark, will hurt my chances of being accepted into many of the schools I am looking at, Harvard, Duke, Georgetown, Chicago, Northwestern, Penn, Columbia, NYU, etc. Okay, so the top 14. My academic performance over the last four semesters has been marred by my lifelong ADHD, which I was only recently diagnosed with. In addition to this, I have been financially independent for the last 2 years and have had to work 20 plus hours a week in order to support myself. This, in combination with my ADHD, has had a negative impact on my grades thus far and will likely continue to prevent me from achieving an impressive UGPA for my future law school applications. I recently began taking medication for my ADHD and have seen considerable improvement in my academic performance. Despite this, my GPA will still likely place me below the median at every top 14 school by the time I begin to apply. I am an underrepresented minority with what I and others believe to be a compelling story. My questions. Is there a way I can better position myself to secure a spot at a T14 school given my relatively poor undergraduate GPA? Would it be worth it to provide an explanation for my low stats in my personal statement? I just recently found the LSAT Demon YouTube channel and have found tremendous value in it so far. I look forward to hearing back from you soon. Kind regards, Mark. Mark's new, so we're going to have to go easy on him a little bit.
Yeah, Mark, I feel like you're running a race. And you're halfway through that race, or not even halfway yet, and you're already trying to figure out how to deal with the fallout of not being first. And I would rather you turn your focus to the race that you're currently running, which is your UGPA.
Couldn't agree more. I don't think you should be studying for the LSAT right now. We want you to be getting straight A's or not studying for the LSAT. You're trying to do too much at once. You're in school and working 20 hours a week and trying to study for the LSAT. The LSAT seems to be, for you, the easiest component of all of this. You're already in the mid-170s. It sounds to me like he thinks he's probably has to apply right away or something, go straight from undergrad right into law school. Mm-hmm. But you're going to end up killing your chances at these top schools with your low GPA. I mean, I know somebody who just got into Harvard with a 3.0. It's like barely over a 3.0 and a 178 and is now in at Harvard. Mm-hmm. But that's the back door. And we don't want you sneaking in the back door. We want you going in through the front door, if possible. The one thing I hated in this that I really wanted to talk about. Just the work in combination with my ADHD has had a negative impact on my grades thus far and will likely continue to prevent me from achieving an impressive UGPA for my future law school applications.
Yeah, we can't do anything about the past, but we can do a lot about the future. You need to start questioning your assumptions.
Yeah, he's throwing in the towel on the rest of his undergrad career. I'm worried that the grades are going to slip even lower than, you know, it was kind of strange that he reported 3.0 to 3.3. That's a pretty wide range. The GPA, you know, like what? 3.0 is a B. 3.3 is a B+. Like, what is it? Are you close? Which one is it? Yeah. And this idea that, like, you know, think about the question he's really asking is something that we get so commonly, which is, how can I better position myself? Would it be worth it to provide an explanation? Yeah, you can write an excuse for sure. But I don't think you want to mention ADHD in your excuse, because then they're going to think you had extra time on the LSAT, which, by the way, you should have extra time on the LSAT. So hopefully you're reporting your scores with your accommodations. I mean, lifelong ADHD, that's a no-brainer. Apply for accommodations and get extra time on the LSAT.
Absolutely.
But if you then disclose that in an addendum, like, well, the reason why I got poor grades is because of my lifelong ADHD. Well, what the, you're not going to not have ADHD when you go to that school.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, you're medicated now. You say that's helping you in your academic performance. There's one thing you can do that will make that actually impact the schools, which is get fucking straight A's now. If you get fucking straight A's now, then you might be able to write a thing that says, I had lifelong ADHD and I never got medicated until my sophomore or junior or whatever it was year. And from that point forward, I got nothing but straight A's.
Yeah. Then the excuse can explain something that was in the past. If the excuse just becomes, this is a reason for my past and present bad grades.
Right.
Then it just becomes like, okay, well, then that's going to continue to be an excuse for your bad grades in law school.
Right.
And here on out.
Yep. As far as your compelling story goes, I'm sure you do have a compelling story, Mark. That's great. That's a feather in your cap. But that can only help on the margins against other similarly situated applicants in terms of LSAT and GPA. If that weren't a fact, then the law schools would have much wider ranges of LSAT and GPAs reported on their ABA 509 reports. So, you know, these people, did you see where he said, and others also believe that I have a compelling story?
Mm-hmm.
So who is that, Mark? Is that like somebody at a law school? Because every law school counselor, every law school admissions consultant, every law school admissions person, they're going to tell you how compelling your story is because they want you to apply. They just want your application. And then they'll decide whether they're going to admit you or deny you. But they want your application. So they're trying to make you feel good about yourself. Oh, don't worry about the bad. You know, the grades, yeah. I mean, boy, you should really do as good as you can. But, you know, you've got a very compelling story. It's like, yeah, well, you can make that story a hell of a lot more compelling if you start getting straight A's right now.
Yeah.
And if that sounds impossible, then my question would be, well, then how are you going to do in law school?
What's going to change? I think Mark is operating within a lot of assumptions, and I want to kind of address each one of them. So one appears to be that he needs to graduate within 4 years, right? And therefore, to do that, he has to take a certain number of credits, and to pay for that, he has to work a certain number of hours per week, and he also is assuming that once he graduates, he's going to go to law school. So he's got to take the LSAT now. It's like, well, you already talked about it. He doesn't need to take the LSAT before he graduates. He could take it after he graduates and then go to law school a year later. He doesn't need to go to law school right away. He doesn't need to graduate within 4 years. So if you have to work, and that's a question too, that's an assumption that I would ask you to really think hard about. Can you make this happen with fewer hours of work? But if you really have to work, okay, well then what other things can give? And maybe the number of credits you're doing per semester can give. You can do fewer and then do better on them. Granted, you may need to stay an extra semester, but that extra semester may give you just enough time to now start knocking out A's as opposed to getting A minuses or worse, right? Or B's, I mean, getting the projections you're giving yourself right now.
And he's in a probably hard, you know, it's a math.
Yeah.
It's a science-y kind of a major. So, like, it's not like we're saying it's easy. Oh, he's a sophomore. You know, he's got, like, 2/3 of his undergrad ahead of him still. But he's already like, he's just given himself this excuse of like, well, I'm going to have low grades.
Yep.
Well, then why are you in school? Like, you shouldn't be in school getting poor grades. You should be getting straight A's. You need to be killing it in school. Otherwise, you're not getting your money's worth.
Yeah, I mean, that's another idea. Pause school for a semester.
But don't use that save for up the money. LSAT.
Yeah, no. You work to save up money or whatever it is that's constraining you, right? Also, I think he talked about getting extended time on the LSAT, right?
Well, he has to be. He's actually medicated for ADHD. That's so, a kick-in accommodations.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you haven't done that, get extended time for the LSAT, but not only for the LSAT, actually don't even worry about the LSAT right now. Yeah. Get extended time for all your exams in school.
Yeah. Like start advocating for yourself right now.
There's so many things you can do. Get the book by Cal Newport, right? How to Get Straight A's.
Get the extra tutoring on campus.
Mm-hmm.
I bet that there's an academic resource center that has like extra special tutoring slots for people with ADHD. I love the extra time on exams idea. Anything that they'll do for you.
Yeah. Anyways, hyper-focus on your grades and start questioning a lot of assumptions that you're making that are hurting your grades or the time you can spend on them.
That's come back and see us in a year or two or whatever, Mark, when you've got straight A's. And you'll be, you know, like that's the front door. That's the way that you're going to get to all of these really top great law schools. He's looking way too far down the road, I feel like.
Yeah.
You're ignoring your undergrad experience because you're worrying about the LSAT, which the LSAT's going to be, it sounds like the LSAT's going to be the easiest part of all of this for you. I would withdraw from August and September. You might be able to get a refund for September. You actually might be able to get a refund for both of them.
Yeah.
So far down the line.
I like that you're a planner, Mark. It's what led to you reaching out to us. But yeah, plan better for your GPA.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, and I can see the pushback, right? I can see if he won't let go of this idea of going to law school immediately upon graduation.
Or graduating within 4 years.
then he's gonna be pushing back with like, well, but can't I just write an addendum to explain the bad grades? And it's like, well, yeah, you can. And the law schools will tell you that, you know, they read every page of your application really carefully and that really matters and stuff. But the admissions offers and the scholarship dollars follow GPA and LSAT.
Yeah.
Super tightly correlated with GPA and LSAT. And your URM status will help you, but you know, you're like wasting time fantasizing about writing this addendum to explain your relatively poor undergraduate grades. And instead you should just be getting better grades.
Yeah. I would say one other thing. I could hear maybe not Mark, but some other people listening to this and say, well, why can't I do both? Why can't I pursue the 4.0 and the LSAT at the same time? Well, fine, do that. Once you have a 4.0, but until you're doing that, you can't do it. You're not doing it. So don't pretend that you can until you are. And so you have to start with the 4.0. And then once you can do that, fine. Add in the LSAT and see if you can maintain it.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's magical thinking, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we appreciate how hard you're working, Mark, and we appreciate how much you want it. And, you know, that's a hell of a lot of, I'm assuming that Mark is like 20 years old or something.
Yeah.
That's like you're doing things at 20 that I never did in my whole life, including like actually studying math in college.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have great respect for all that. But our advice is not going to be write some addendum. Our advice is going to be the facts are what matters to a lawyer. And the people who are admitting you to their law school ultimately are lawyers because you're going to be a lawyer. And lawyers are driven by facts and your GPA is just a fact. And that's one of the most powerful facts on your whole application. Yeah.
Well, that's the key too, is of all the facts, which are the most important, UGPA and LSAT.
Yeah. So not only that, but you'll get more out of undergrad if you get better grades.
Yeah.
Think about everything else in his application. He'll have like better letters of recommendation. He'll have tighter connections to these people who might be able to help him in some future career. He'll be
better prepared for law school, period. It's like, okay, I pulled out a 4.0 at the end of my, in the last 2 years of my undergrad in applied mathematics and econ. Law school, yeah, be different, but it won't be as challenging.
That's a great way to think about it. You need, Mark, you need to learn how to kick ass in school. And so you can use these undergrad classes as a proving ground, training ground for law school. Law school is going to be harder than your undergrad. Like I was just talking, Ben, to Sarah. We our Sarah was on the Harvard Sarah.
Yep,
It was on a daily episode with me, and she was talking about how she's never worked this hard in her whole entire life.
Yeah,
she's a 1L at Harvard, and it's like to get into Harvard, you have to bust your ass. And she now is like, I just had no idea what hard work was. And I've heard that from other people at top law schools.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like people think they're going to just, oh, well, all I got to do is just get in. No, no. You need to become an academic killer because you're going to be doing battle with nothing but academic killers.
Yeah. Start seeing yourself as a gladiator, an academic gladiator. Stop seeing yourself as someone who's, you know, sliding in, as you said, the back door. And
because the prioritization is a skill, right? Like I think that's what people don't realize is that that's part of it. In fact, it's probably a huge part of it to be able to prioritize and say no to the things that are keeping you from getting the A.
Yeah.
Like, you know, in Mark's email, he's providing multiple excuses, right? It's the ADHD, but it's also the working 20 hours plus per week.
Yeah.
Well, okay, then you need to start eliminating some of those things. And the LSAT's the easiest first one to go. Like, stop thinking about the LSAT.
Stop thinking about your personal statement.
Okay. Stop thinking about your personal statement. Stop thinking about your addendums to law school. And then we can start thinking about, like, potentially cutting down on work hours, taking fewer credits. But essentially, just do whatever you have to do to get an A in every class. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to.
Yep. Thank you, Mark, for writing in. Anything else?
That's it. Thanks for listening to the LSAT Demon Daily Digest. You can email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.